One was a sacred called Yomri Noam, which was an Agadita. And the other was a Kabbalistic sefer by a great tzaddik, who's a little older than the Grata. But the Gras HaSkomis was when he was young. It was when he was 39 or 40. He didn't give it. The last 30 years of his life, he didn't give anything.
Must be pretty professional as far.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. Hello. Hello. What's up for today? Yeah.
I was learning in Halachas of Shabbos.
You can sit down if you want to.
I was learning Halachas of Shabbos for saving a life. And it keeps on saying for Yisrael, Yisrael, Yisrael.
Yeah.
I can infer that these laws of breaking Shabbos only applies for Yisrael. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is very true, and that raises a great question. I mean, there's absolutely the din, but we'll see how we apply it, is that Pikuach Nefesh allows you to violate Shabbos only to save a Jewish life, and Pikuach Nefesh does not allow you to violate Shabbos to save a non-Jewish life. That is the halacha, and that's clear from the Mishnah in Yuma. But the poskim say, and the Mishnah Berurah brings this as well, that in a situation where by not saving non-Jewish lives, there's going to be hatred towards the Jewish people, and therefore, in a long-term scenario, you're endangering Jewish lives. Mm-hmm. Either there'll be a riot, or they're not going to save our lives. So because of the principle that is called Eva, that is called hatred of Jews, that this might cause, so we are allowed to desecrate Shabbos for non-Jews, but we do so by making it a malacha d'rabbanan instead of d'oraisa. Now that's pretty easy to do, because any malacha you do with the shinui, if you turn on a light with your elbow or with your knuckle, it becomes only rabbinic law. So there was a story a few years ago in the newspaper. Again, the secular papers like to always create antagonism, about a non-Jew that had a heart attack in a Haredi neighborhood, and Shabbos, and there were like 100 Haredim around, and nobody lifted a finger to call 911 or get an ambulance or a doctor, and the person died. It turned out the whole story was a lie. It just didn't even happen.
There was no
person who had a heart attack, you know. But if God forbid such a thing would happen, so we would be permitted to dial with our knuckle and, you know, get the ambulance and everything else. So as a matter of fact, therefore, practically, halacha does say you save the life of a non-Jew. Now, the question that people raise, just to be honest, is, well, that may solve the technical problem, but does it solve the ethical and philosophical problem? Meaning, if you were to ask, in other words, are you basically telling me that Hashem says the life of a non-Jew is not as valuable as the life of a Jew? Now, yes, we have a way out. You do it with your elbow, do it with your knuckle. So Lamaisa, we're going to save the non-Jew. But even then, the rationale is not because the non-Jew's life is important.
Right.
The rationale is because if I don't save the non-Jew, they're going to hurt the Jews. Right? So the question becomes, what about the ethics of this? Right? Don't we say that all human life is precious? And all human life was made in the image of God, which is true, actually. The statement that man is made in the image of God is going on non-Jews as well. So it's a good question. And, you know, there are Gedolim that have said, privately at least, that this is part of the Torah that they find very, very difficult to fully understand. But I would just suggest a simple explanation, kind of a simple one. And that is, it's not that non-Jewish life is not important, but it's that Shabbos is so important that we only violate Shabbos for those who will be able to keep the Shabbos. And since the non-Jew does not have the mitzvah of keeping the Shabbos, so Shabbos is that important. Meaning it's not that human life is less important, it's that Shabbos is so important it can only be overridden for somebody. Now, I'm not going to say somebody who keeps Shabbos, because then you might make the mistake and think, oh, if he's not religious, don't save his life. That's not true. But somebody that has the mitzvah of keeping Shabbos, who may therefore keep Shabbos. That might be a little bit of an explanation. Yeah.
Still on that topic, we also learn that the halakha applies to saving a Jew's spiritual life. So how does that work exactly? If we believe that you can't convert out of Judaism, so then surely maybe there would always be a hope that even if they convert out, there'd be a chance that they could come back to Judaism.
No, that's absolutely the case. But nevertheless, no Jew can ever totally sever himself from being Jewish. Even if a Jew converts to Christianity, we don't recognize that conversion. He is still a Jew. But still, the likelihood of him coming back is small, and as a result, we consider it as he's endangering his share in the world to come. In other words, you don't simply say, "Oh, since he can always come back." Well, but how many Jews who convert to Christianity do come back? So that's called the pikuach nefesh that you have. By the way, this is a very interesting issue, in which the secular law of Israel is actually stricter than halacha. You know, the very first law that was passed by the Knesset in 1948 is the very famous law called the Law of Return. And the Law of Return guarantees every Jew the right of citizenship in Israel. So in the 1960s, there was a Jewish guy who converted to Catholicism and became a priest. And he wanted to make Aliyah for some reason. I'm not sure exactly why. As a Christian, he wanted to make Aliyah. So according to halacha, he's Jewish. But the secular law of Israel said, by converting to another religion, you have renounced your Jewish identity. And they actually did not give him the right to make Aliyah. So that's interesting. So this is a strange idea that the Knesset was stricter than secular law.
I understand that if food has been stored under a bed while someone's been sleeping on the bed, then it should not be consumed. I was wondering if that's true and if that also applies to sealed packages, sealed bottles of water.
Yeah. This is an area that's very murky because this is a Kabbalistic concept that is called Ruach Ra'ah. Ruach Ra'ah is a term that you see a lot, that bad spirits, bad ruach, bad wind, etc. This is what we say, that when you wake up in the morning, you have to wash your hands, because since the godly neshama left and all you have is the physical nefesh, there's a ruach ra that remains on your hands even after the rest of it left your body. This is why when you're in a cemetery, you have to wash your hands because of ruach ra. And among the halachas that we say is that food that is under a bed should not be eaten because of ruach ra'ah. Although you actually have an etzah, you can do nekovasar on food. People don't know this. You can actually take, if an apple was under my bed, I have to wash it three times the way you wash hands. And the ruach ra'ah goes off the food as well. Strictly speaking, most poskim say it does not apply to sealed packages. It only applies to open things. But some people do are machmir, and it is brought down that in ruach ra, which is a Kabbalistic idea, it's better to err on the side of being strict. So mi'ikar adin, it would appear to be mutter, but it is better not to put it under your bed.
So if one does the nagel vasser on, let's say, an apple, does that mean that even a machmir opinion would say it's okay to eat that?
Yes.
What about a sealed bottle of bottled water that's never been opened? How do you do nagel vasser?
Well, how do you do nagel vasser on water? That's also true. I don't know if you guys, see, I don't know if anything's going to work there, because certainly doing nagel vasser on the outside of the bottle is not going to help, because if there's the ruach ra, it's like in the water, it's not outside of the water. So how you would do it, I'm not sure. Perhaps immersion in a mikveh would do the trick, meaning to say you'd have to uncap it, and the waters of the mikveh would have to go over the very top of the bottle, so the waters kiss. That's the expression. There's hashaka of the water. But I'm not sure. I'm going to have to think about it exactly. Exactly what do you do with liquids? Yeah. Yes.
I was wondering, could the Rav give us an explanation of the Torah's understanding of the psychology of men and women, specifically, like, why only a man can divorce a woman, derives, and also that a man can have many wives, and a woman is not one husband.
Yeah, well, these are difficult issues. I mean, the one thing that you have to keep in mind, and I'm sure you've heard this over and over and over again, but it's just true, and that is men and women are different. They're intended to be different. The Torah does not embrace a unisex concept, nor does the Torah say that the differences of men and women are environmentally based. They are existential and they are fundamental. Having said that, men and women are different. They see the world differently. They view reality differently. It is not a question of superior and inferior. They are equally beloved, equally cherished by God, and it is only the totality of men and women coming together which allows us to perceive a total reality. That is why we say, again, I don't want to say anything negative to single gentlemen yet, but that's why the Zohar says that until you're married, you are half a person. Now, that doesn't suggest a handicap or anything, but it just means that the male perception of reality is incomplete without the feminine aspect, and the same thing is equally true for a woman. So, yes, although American law says separate but equal doesn't apply, right? That was the old school discrimination thing, but we believe separate can be equal, and indeed separate is equal, right? That's a very important idea. Men and women are different. I know I didn't get to your question yet. The truth of the matter is, even second-generation feminists have recognized this. You know, the first-generation feminists, which is before you guys were born, were trying to create what was called a unisex culture, in which men and women even dressed the same and everything else. But then they came to the understanding, which the Torah always had, that when you tell a woman that the only way you can achieve fulfillment is by imitating what a man does, that is actually the biggest put-down of a woman, because it's telling her what she is really worthless, but she can try to become like a man. So what second-generation feminism does, or post-feminism, as called, is actually trying to create a recognition of uniqueness and distinction, as opposed to sameness and identity. And that's exactly the Torah's perspective all along, that women have a very unique role, just as men. Now, we have to be careful, you know. Sometimes people get into this habit. After we talk, you know, people think, oh, the Torah considers men to be better than women, so we give a whole bunch of shumar. No, women are better than men. You know, I don't want to go there either. I don't want to say men are better than women and women are better than men. Rather, Kedusha requires both men and women. So in a general, in a kind of a general way, you try to, you can't always do this, but you try to understand the individual halachos as reflective of the different personalities that men and women have. Now, one idea that the Torah considers to be very essential is that women are considered to be, again, these are generalizations, they don't apply to every man or every woman, seem to have a superior ability to create relationships and community. A man has the koach to intensely focus on one thing, like Gemara. A woman has a superior focus to multitask without necessarily focusing intensely. And there's a context of relationships. There was a test, a famous social psychologist, Carol Gilligan, gave a test to young children. Listen to this question about how little boys and little girls answer questions differently. This involved, let's say you had a child, the child was sick, and the child needed medicine, and the only way you would get the medicine is in a drugstore that was closed for the night. And what do you do if the drugstore is closed? And, you know, so every single boy answered, you take a rock, and you break a window, and you take the medicine. Now, that is a correct answer, actually, because bikuach nefesh, you know, that is a good answer. The girls who answered the question said, you know, if you have to take a rock, you do so, but you leave a note for the drugstore owner, or you call the police ahead of time. In other words, the concept is this. Men tend to focus on the main issue, and they pursue it with great intensity. Women will often notice the peripheral side details, which are mekushar to relationships. Now, if it is understood that a woman is the custodian, so to speak, of creating a relationship, and in the case of a home, creating a home. So the concept is this. The Torah permits men, d'oraisa, to have more than one wife, because the Torah, in effect, does not expect a man inherently to be totally loyal. Men, you know, their mind wanders, their passions wander. But a woman who is the foundation of the house, so committed to that bias that she's not allowed to have other husbands, because otherwise she would not be able to contribute her koach to the building of the house. Now, divorce is somewhat of the same way. The Torah does not want, now this creates aguna problems, it's very true, but the Torah does not want a woman to be able to divorce her husband, because the Torah wants the woman to be so committed to the home that she will work harder to get it there. Now you might say, well, is it fair that a woman has the burden? I mean, the truth is both people have the burden, but the Torah considers the woman more gifted and more capable and more able to fulfill that role, and therefore the Torah put it on her. So it's kind of a role that was given to her because of her superior abilities in being committed to a relationship and in making a relationship work. Now, I'm not sure if that's it. It's not, well, I know it's not a complete answer, but part of it is the Torah withholds the ability to get out of something where the Torah considers the person to have the greater ability to work on a relationship.
So people often say doing certain actions is a segula for parnasa, a segula for health, and all that.
Yeah.
And it seems sometimes it can be overused that it's a segula is like a quick fix. how do we actually understand what a segula is?
I'll tell you two short thoughts about segula. First, somebody pointed out that there is a segula for parnasa that is the oldest segula, because it's at the very, very beginning of the Torah, and it was given all the way to other Marishan. And that segula is b'zeyas apecha tocha lechem, which means get a job. So the Torah itself says that is the segula for parnasa. The second thing about segula is that somebody asked the Sfas Emes about whether something is a segula for a bracha. So the Sfas Emes says the best segula for a bracha is v'hayisam li segula mikol ha'amim. When Hashem said to Bnei Yisrael before Matan Torah, you shall be for me a precious treasure. The way you live your life. That's the word segula, means a treasure. So you want a segula, you be a segula. And if you be a segula, your zaycha to Hashem's bracha. So the truth of the matter is, in the non-Hasidish world until fairly recently, the idea of these shortcuts, these amulets, these magic water, red strings, necklaces, chamsa things, whatever they are, they were not treated with a great deal of respect. They were considered to be artificial. They were considered to be fake. They were considered to be superstitious. And some of them are borrowed, frankly, from Arabic culture. The chamsa thing is not a Jewish thing. It's really from Islamic culture that was adopted. So, generally speaking, our Derech of Avodas Hashem focuses much more on Torah and on mitzvos and on tefillah and on stukah and then masim tovim. And that is the real segula. Now, having said that, however, there is no question that Mekubalim have said that certain physical objects are vehicles that channel blessing to you, certain types of jewels and things that tzaddikim bless. So I'm not going to deny that a segula is a way of connecting to ruchnius, but a lot of the power of the physical object comes from the kavanos and the brachos that you bring to it by your good deeds. So a segula can be, on some level, a bit of a booster shot, but it cannot do the job alone. Meaning to say, Torah and mitzvahs without a segula is a lot. A segula without Torah or mitzvahs is worthless. Torah or mitzvahs plus segula, there may be some marginal incremental gain, but the bulk of the work is still done by the Torah and the mitzvahs. So why the segulas have any effect at all, it's hard for us to understand, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu did create in the Teva, just like there are herbs that can heal you, so there are certain objects that can have spiritual powers, but it's really the Torah and the mitzvahs that is always going to be the ikriya.
I heard that there's a Masechet Sanhedrin that says that Oyv Melech HaBashan and Eliezer Eved Avraham were the same person. So is that literal, and what's the explanation of that?
Well, the Pashas, it would not be literal. Now, of course, Og and Eliezer did have a commonality, and that is the Medrash tells us when Avraham waged war, right? Avraham sided with five kings against the four kings, and Lot was taken captive. According to the Medrash, Avraham's army consisted of Eliezer. Eliezer was Avraham's army. Now, the person who told Avraham that Eliezer was captured, I'm sorry, that Lot was captured, was Og Melech HaBashan, for Yavo HaPalit. So Og is the one that tells Avraham that Lot was captured, because Og was hoping that Avraham would get killed, and he would be able to marry Sarah. Eliezer is the one that ransomed Lot. So according to the Medrash, they are clearly two different people, because Og is the one that told Avram about Lot. Eliezer is the one that saved Avram and Lot. So when you read something in Masechet Sofrim that they're one and the same person, it probably, I didn't hear that message before, it would not necessarily mean they're the same person, but it means that they were two parts of the story, that, in other words, they're this two halves of a whole that gave Abraham his godless and his respect among the nations. That is, Og was the one that got him to fight, and Eliezer was the one that actually did the fighting. So together, they created a Shlemus. So Og was part of the Kiddush Hashem, which occurred when Avraham Avinu was Minatseach in a very difficult Muhammad. You see the idea. They're two halves of a whole.
There are a number of examples in biology that show that the male reproductive system is wasteful. It's designed to be wasteful. Like seminal missions is a good example. Why did Hashem create us like that when it also gives us a mitzvah which teaches the importance of not wasting seed?
That is a good question. It's hard to understand why when there is waste within the human body, you wonder why it is so. Part of it is in a very general way. This is a very, very general answer. The Medrash sometimes says that because man is made, human beings are made in the image of God. They're free will, they have intelligence. So there needs to be a certain amount of decrepitness within the human system in order that man should not have the gaiva and the arrogance and the hubris of thinking they're godlike. So in many, many ways, some of the features, whether it's aging, whether it's the wrinkling of skin, whether it's acne, all sorts of things that seem to be imperfections in the perfection of man, are kind of built-in correctives to the natural arrogance that a person would have because they feel they're gods. I don't have a more specific answer, but that could be a part of it, yeah.
I understand the Kohanim, at the time of the base of Migdash, needed to sit there and eat a lot of meat from people's sacrifices.
Yep.
Especially during the times of joy, the holidays.
Yep.
I also understand that they had to eat so much meat that they had to have a lot of stomach doctors on hand, and it was a painful experience.
That's correct.
It was a big toil for
them. They were
meat.
Sick, yeah.
So why did Hashem design the system?
They also had to be barefoot in the cold, because the Avodah was outside. And the Avodah had to be done without shoes or socks.
So why did Hashem design the system such that, especially in these times of joy, the Kohanim had to suffer so much?
Well, it is a good question. I mean, I could tell you that, when the Torah was given, it did not necessarily envision such a huge population, but that wouldn't be true. Obviously, Hashem knew how many Jews there would be. You have to understand that eating korbanos is mystical food. Eating korbanos is ruchniyistika food. Right? There's a certain spiritual kedusha to it. And when a kohen or a tzaddik reaches a certain madrega, where their pleasure and their joy is more spiritual than physical, then in a sense, even if the body is suffering, the simcha from the doing of the mitzvah is so great that they need a doctor, but on some level they could transcend the consciousness of their suffering. It's a hard thing to say. It's similar, for example, I'll give you an example from a totally unrelated area. You've all heard of these stories of adrenaline where the woman, a car falls on a baby, and the woman lifts up the car, totally beyond her strength. But she's able to do it for a moment, even though she'll be in the hospital 6 months after that, because, her body fell apart. I think you have to look at the Avodah this way, meaning to say, at the time of the actual mitzvah, there was a joy and a tremendous connection to God. The after effects came afterwards, because when the ruchnius left, they're then left with the gashmius, and the gashmius, can overcome them. But at the time of the Maisa, I don't think it took away from the joy. I think the joy was so elevated that they were not even aware of that physical deprivation. Now, you can still ask, okay, so that didn't take away from the Yom Tov. But still, why does God give them a mitzvah that requires them to suffer? Well, you have to look at it this way. Imagine a situation. Let's take a Rosh Yeshiva, right? You have a yeshiva, even our Sameach, but other yeshivas maybe even more so. Sometimes in a very big yeshiva, there may be a chasna every night. And a Rosh Yeshiva or a Rebbe may actually go to a chasna every night. Sometimes he may go to two or three weddings a night. Now, after a while, the truth of the matter is, weddings get to be a drag. Somebody told me a beautiful chat from Rav Chaim Shulevitz. Rav Chaim Shulevitz, who's a Shiva of Mir, a great gadol. But the thing about Rav Chaim that was so wonderful is he was so honest. He used to say, you know, say things that, you know, you normally wouldn't say because of political correctness. He once said his favorite combination of circumstances is when he's not invited to a wedding, because that gives him two things. He's joking. He says, number one, he doesn't have to go. And number two, he gets to complain that he wasn't invited. So there's a certain feeling, right? He says, he liked that combination that, you know, why didn't he invite me? Even though he's quite happy he wasn't invited. Now, but what's the right attitude? The right attitude is, well, maybe for me, it's the 10th wedding this week. But for the guy that's getting married, it's the one time he's getting married. You understand the idea? You have to look at it as a very, very important day for him. Now, think about it this way. I'm a Kohen in the Beis HaMikdash. Now, for me, it might be the 100th, you know, Korban somebody's bringing that day. But for each Jewish family that's bringing the Korban, this is special. This is unique. And the Kohen is there to help them get elevated in their Simcha. So maybe part of the lesson is that to help other Jews feel closer to God and experience joy, it's worthwhile to suffer a little bit. Just like you go to the 100th wedding, even though for you it's the 100th wedding. But for the chassan and the kala, it's the first wedding. So I would say maybe the Kohen is the same thing, that the Kohen has to get a bellyache a little bit. Because maybe for him it's the 100th korban, but for the Jew that's bringing his shalmei simcha, it's the first one. It's the first and only one. So that's kind of the way you have to look at it.
Were they vomiting from the amount of food they had to eat?
You know, I have not seen the medical reports, I have to admit. but I'll tell you a halacha. One halacha I will tell you, and that is, anyone that eats so much that they have to vomit, they're not yotzei the mitzvah of eating the korban. So at whatever point they would become that sick, they would not be allowed to force it down. So we would have to assume that it did not reach that level. Otherwise, that's called achila gasa. And the Gemara says an achila gasa that would result in vomiting is an aveira. It's not a mitzvah at all, and you do not fulfill the mitzvah of achilas kacha. So we have to assume that every kohen ate till they were maybe uncomfortably full, but it didn't go beyond that point. Yeah.
There seems to be a perspective and a worldview of the past. Pulling the past is like more. Question important, for example, like Mabush,
yeah,
and also like the Mashalim, like kings and princes and Avadim. So, other than, is there an idea other than Yeridus Adoros which would give support to this perspective of this worldview?
Well, they give Yeridus Adoros is simply because Matan Torah was the epitome of our revelation, and therefore the further we get from Matan Torah, the further we are from direct contact with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And of course we don't even have Nevuah today, right? So we don't even have the Navi. But the truth of the matter is, Nisqatnu Adoros, you know, you don't necessarily need proofs. I mean, I think, at least I've seen in my own lifetime, I've seen, you know, a Nisqatnu Adoros. I don't know if you've yet noticed it, but, you know, you can notice a Nisqatnu Adoros as the time goes on. And this doesn't only mean in the greatest Gedolim, Nisqatnu Adoros, even average Jews, you know, there's a certain Nisqatnu Adoros. Now, I'm not going to tell you every single Jew who lived 100 is better than every single Jew who lived today. That's not true. You had Rishayim 100 years ago too, and I'm not going to say, oh, those Rishayim were better than our Rishayim. You know, I'm not going to say that. But it means on the average there's been a great, great Yerida. Our culture is more decadent. Our culture is more spoiled. People don't work as hard for things. These are true. There was even a study. This is very strange because Judaism doesn't make this claim. That the average IQ, this is a secular study, is 15 points lower than it was 100 years ago. Now that's actually very major. And how do they know this? They didn't give IQ tests in 100 years ago, but you know, they were able to figure out by what was an assigned reading in fourth grade. Let's say fourth grade in the United States in 1880 would be like 10th grade in high school today, what they expected people to know. The amount of information people used to memorize was much, much greater because now we have internet, whatever it is, people's computational ability has declined because we have calculators. And all sorts of things. Talents have atrophied. So Niskata Odoris does manifest itself in a lot of ways, but according to our tradition, it's not so much in the brains as it is in the sense of morality and reverence for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it goes back to the fact that the further you get from the epitome experience, like right to the less Kedusha is left over. In fact, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was once on a plane, and he was sitting next to a very prominent secular Zionist leader, Dr. Nachum Goldman, who was the president of the Jewish Agency. He was called the Jewish Pope. He controlled like all of the Jewish non-religious organizations. And he noticed that Rav Yaakov was in first class, because he was an older man, he was already in his 80s. And of course, Nachum Goldman was in first class because he always went first class. But Rav Yaakov's grandchildren were going back and forth every 20 minutes to see if he needed anything. And Dr. Goldman said to Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, gee, you know, my grandchildren don't even talk to me, or they're not interested in spending time with me. Why do your grandchildren have such a relationship with you? So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said the following. You believe that man was created from monkey. So as a result, the further back you go, the closer you are to the monkey, so things only get better and better and better as time goes by. So why should they spend time with a less developed human? We believe that the epitome was Matan Torah, and therefore the prior Doros were connected to Matan Torah. So as a result, in a Torah society, the younger want to connect to the older, in a way that in a secular society, the younger will try to distance themselves. So that's kind of the basic idea of Niskatna Wadoros. So if you're asking me what's the proof, I mean, the truth is we actually can see a proof, but the basic idea is connected to Matan Torah.
In the morning when we say Elokai Neshama Shinasata, how come we don't say Elokai Hanashama?
Well, why would you say, because you're referring to a specific Neshama?
It seems more grammatically correct.
Elokai Neshama, Elokai Hanashama. I have to think about it. I don't have a direct answer. I have a feeling, I suggest, that it may be connected with not having two consecutive hays. Now, although a lokai ends with a yud, but since the yud is simply an accentuation of the hay, right? So there's a general rule that you don't have two consecutive hays. So I have a feeling it's connected to that dictum, but I'll try to check it out. Yeah.
I've read that the Rambam either did not learn Kabbalah or no Kabbalah. I don't want to misquote that or misunderstand it. To what extent is that true, or is it true?
Well, it's hard for us to know exactly, but the Rambam, of course, was the epitome of the rationalist. The Rambam felt that the Torah needed to be understood in a rational, philosophical basis. He wrote the Guide to the Perplexed to reconcile received tradition, Torah min Hashemayim, with Aristotelian philosophy, which in turn is based on logic. In fact, Aristotle is the founder of formal logic. Aristotle developed syllogism, and or at least he articulated the syllogism and the like. So as a result, the Rambam did not believe in things that are not susceptible to rationality. He did believe in the miracles the Torah tells you occurred, because the Torah tells you they occurred. But anything that's not in the Torah, such as demons, magic, and the like, the Rambam claimed was either metaphorical or had alternative meanings, but it was not intended to be literal. Now, as a result, whether the Rambam was familiar with Kabbalistic teachings or not, it's hard for us to know, but a lot of the stuff in Kabbalah the Rambam would not have accepted. He would not have accepted the demonology of Kabbalah, the different levels of angels of Kabbalah. So I think it's fair to say the Rambam was not a Mekubal in that way. Now, some people have a legend that towards the end of his life, he saw the Zohar, and he repudiated everything. Yeah, but those types of stories about the last minute, you know, the Rambam repudiated everything he wrote. I'm willing to tell you they're not true. They're not true stories. But the Rambam was not a Mekubal, that much we can say. Whether he was aware of Kabbalah or not is hard for us. It's hard for us to say. Something about the Rambam that I want to make clear. Since the Rambam is defined as a rationalist, so people often think that means he was cold, unfeeling, non-passionate, no emotion, just like a computer. That's not really true. If you look at the way the Rambam describes the love of Hashem, in the Rambam's lexicon, maybe it's something we don't fully understand, when you intellectually comprehend the nature of God, the Rambam says your heart is filled with a deep emotional love. It's kind of an emotional arousal coming from the depths of the intellect. Now, a Litvak can understand that somewhat. We say this in our learning of Torah itself, that through the learning of Torah, one can come to emotional rapture. And it's very, very clear that the Rambam had a deep emotional rapture. And in fact, the word he used for love of God was love sickness, love craziness, as it were. But that comes from intellectual cogitation. Now, again, for most of us, it's hard to understand that because we perceive of the intellect and the emotion as two different things. The Rambam felt that the intellect arouses a deep emotion, and that's a much more meaningful activity. By the way, that is the shorish of Chabad Chassidus. Chabad Chassidus is fundamentally based on this Rambam. Chabad Lubavitch, I don't mean the way it's become today, but the original idea, Chachma Bin Adas, meaning the Alter Rebbe, didn't like the fact that Chassidus was emphasizing emotion so much. He wanted Chassidus to emphasize the mind and the intellect. And by that's why it's called Chabad, Chachma Bina Das. Right? Non-Chabad Chassidus was called Chagat, Chesed Gevurah Teferes, which are emotional attributes. And Chabad was supposed to be a system that replaced Chagat, and it was based on the idea that the intellect should trigger the emotion instead of just arousing the emotion. That's why Chabad was the only Chassidus that worked in Lithuania, right? The Litvisha personality was a very intellectual personality. They couldn't go for emotional Chassidus. So Chabad was the Chassidus for the Litvak, so to speak. Yeah.
Why is he often spelled in the Chumash with the Hevalo?
Which word didn't hear you?
He.
Oh, well, why is it spelled? Yeah. That's a good question. Hebrew is confusing, right? Because who is he and he is she, right? You have all those problems about this and that. So now he is, the way we spell it today, is hey yud aleph. There it was hey vav aleph, which would normally be read who. So the grammatically correct answer actually is that biblical Hebrew, the rules of modern Hebrew, and in fact in biblical Hebrew, a vav often represented a silent letter, just like a yud. So in a sense, it was literally interchangeable. I mean, that's the grammatical answer. Sometimes, you have to go through the context, sometimes the remez of using what is typically a masculine word for a feminine word might connote that we're talking about a young girl who has not reached puberty, or maybe even a girl below the age of 3. So you have to look at the context. So it uses the masculine as if to suggest she has not been differentiated yet from a boy in a significant way. So depending on the context, in fact, if you look in the Parsha of Rivka, it uses hey, vav, aleph all the time, and some say that that is one of the ramazim to Chazal that Rivka was only 3 years old, was very young, and that's why it uses a masculine term. Yeah.
Is there any inyanim or even halacha that if an animal is shechted, that to use every part, besides we get enough, but to use every part of the animal and not let it go to waste, besides what we're not allowed to eat?
Well, there's not a specific halacha that you have to use every part of an animal. There is a general halacha in the Torah called Bal Tashchis. Now, Bal Tashchis says when you come to a city, you're besieging a city of the Canaanim, so you don't destroy the fruit trees, because the fruit trees are productive. But the Gemara in Bava Kamma says that although Bal Tashchis is specifically referring to fruit trees, it's a much more general mitzvah not to waste things for no reason. You don't break things, you don't throw away food if you don't have to throw away food and the like. So thus the Torah more or less endorses recycling, reusing things, not wasting things. So in that sense, it has always been the hanhaga of Bal Tashchis to use as much as you can use. But Bal Tashchis doesn't require that you be a human garbage disposal. Meaning to say, if there's food that, you don't like or you find repulsive, even if it's technically edible, you know, we don't say I have to force myself to eat it, because otherwise there's baal tashkas. So I wouldn't say there's a specific. Did someone tell you actually heard?
No. I was just wondering. I was watching the Empire Slaughterhouse, and for them, like, they take the trick, like the back half of the animal.
Yes.
In America, it's very hard. They just
That's correct. Yeah, but a lot of that is economic driven as well. You know, now there is a big avla. If you ever go to a wedding or bar mitzvah, if you see the amount of food that is thrown away, it really is a shanda, because especially when you have poor families like we have in Yerushalayim, you know, this could feed a 1,000 families for 2 weeks. And yet, in America at least, there's all sorts of laws. This is really a problem. The leftover food from affairs cannot even be sent to a homeless shelter because of sanitary concerns and the like. Now in Israel, they're a little more makeup on sanitary concerns. So as a matter of fact, the food often does get used, which is more or less a good thing. But in the United States, it has to go into the garbage. It cannot be given to the homeless or anything like that. So that is a baal tashkas issue, because there you're not just throwing away, you know, the ends of something. You're throwing away whole meals that could feed people.
Why do we say va'anit tefil asi just before we take out the Torah? Seems like that should come before Shemot Esrei, maybe just after. Why right at the Torah reading?
Right. In other words, you're talking about specifically Shabbos Mincha.
Yeah, va'anit tefil asi l'cha Hashem esrachan elokim
barasah. Right. Yeah. So there's a few things. It's a very good question. Anit tefil asi is actually not going on Kriyas HaTorah. It's going on the Mincha that you're gonna do. Now the question is, okay, so why do I say it before Torah reading? Let me say it right before Mincha, right before Shemon Esrei, that is. The answer is this. The answer is, if you look up that pasuk in Tehillim, you will see that right beforehand, David HaMelech is talking about people who waste their time sitting in marketplaces and waste their time with idle chatter. But as for me, I offer my prayers to God. Now the Gemara explains that David HaMelech is actually saying that unlike the people who waste their time, I try to learn Torah. And by learning Torah, and Hashem sees I try to use my life in a good way, my prayers are going to become accepted by God. So what you're saying is, my prayer will be offered to God at a time of acceptance, because I am learning Hashem's Torah, which is the Kriyas HaTorah. So it's a reason. Why is my prayer going to be B'yeis Ratzon? Because of the Torah that I'm going to be learning. Remember, Kriyas HaTorah is really supposed to be learning, not davening. We get it mixed up because we have it during davening. But Kriyas HaTorah is a learning session, actually. That's why there used to be a mitorgamen who would translate every verse. And even now, you should try to follow along with the translation, or at least know what the psukim say. So David HaMelech is saying, it's the zechus of Torah that will make my tefillah be accepted by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yeah.
You know the difference between a regular electric shaver and a lift and cut?
Well, this is a very, very big machlokas, but the psak had been, again, some people are more machmer today, so it's hard to know. The Torah prohibits what is called destroying the beard. Destroying the beard. Now, destroying the beard means that a hair, like a razor, the hair has to be severed all the way down to the root. Right? Consider a single blade razor is the prototype of that. So those who matir electric shavers do so because they say, because of the shield, right, there's a shield, the electric shaver does not cut the hair down to the root. If you were to run your hand along your face, you would still feel some stubble or some hair, even if it's very, very small. So that would be the heter. It is not ke'ein tar. Tar is a single blade razor. An electric shaver is not ke'ein tar. Now the problem with the lift and shave model is that even though there's a shield, the lift and shave pulls the hair up, so even past the shield, you're cutting all the way down to the root, and therefore a lift and shave would have the status of a single blade razor and would be usher. Now, it may not be Doraisa. Doraisa, it may only be if it is a single blade razor, but be it as it may, it would at least be Usher to Rabbanan. If it's not a lift and shave, so people are somech on the shield. Now, many poskim are machra. I'm not here to give you a psak in this. There actually is a website, I think it's Electric Shaver or something, I don't remember what it is, which goes through different models. And some poskim are very machra on almost all electric shavers, unless you blunt. I know Rav Moshe Heinemann in Baltimore says, you take your electric shaver, turn it on, run your key through it, let it get blunted by your key, and then already, assuming it still works, it's not going to cut that closely, and then it would be a kosher shaver. Other people do rely on anything that's not a lift and shave, a lift and a shave, but a lift and cut, you certainly cannot do, because that's considered to be a tar. Yeah.
What are the basic halachas of an adopted child and his relation with his adopted family? Like, for example, could he marry his sisters?
Yeah, it's a very, 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 very good question. First, let me emphasize that although raising an orphan, giving a child a home is a great, great mitzvah, and it's a wonderful thing to do, but halachically, halacha does not recognize adoption as conferring parenthood, meaning to say, if I adopt a child, it's a mitzvah, and you know that child, I can take care of that child, but halachically I'm not the father, and halachically he's not my son, so he would not inherit with other sons. He would not be chayav to say Kaddish or sit Shiva, although he would be allowed and even encouraged to do so. And that's true whether it's a Jewish adoption or a non-Jewish adoption. If it's a non-Jewish adoption, even more so, because he has to undergo a conversion. So he's certainly not related. Now, a very important question arises, well, if halachically he's not my child, so let's say I adopt a girl, is there going to be at some point an issue of yichud? A father can have yichud with a daughter, a father can hug and kiss a daughter, but can a father hug and kiss an adopted daughter, or can a father have yichud with an adopted daughter? Same thing with a son, right? A mother can hug and kiss a son, a mother can have yichud with a son, can a mother have yichud with an adopted child? Now, I'm not talking about when they're a baby. I'm talking about whatever age these yeshurim come in, let it be 11, let it be 10, you know, whatever the age is. We're not talking about early childhood. So this is a big machlokas. Now, I have to tell you, most poskim are actually machmer. Most poskim say that whenever the age of yichud and negiah kick in, just for convenience, let's assume it's 11, okay, although we can talk about that too, there would actually be an isser of chibuk, an isser of hugging, kissing, and an isser of yichud. However, and this is most poskim do say that. I have to be honest. But there is a minority view of the Tzitz Eliezer. And the Tzitz Eliezer makes the following argument. He makes the argument that the reason there is no isser of yichud and negiah for a child is not because of the biological connection, but it's because of the fact that there will generally not be improper erotic urges to people you raised from infancy, unless there's a perversion. So he says, it's not totally on whether they're biologically your child, it's totally on whether you raise them from infancy. And therefore the Tzitz Eliezer paskens that if a baby was adopted as an infant, now it's not clear, but it seems to be no later than a year old, so there's a makom to be makel for yichud and negiah. Of course, what's interesting to me is I wonder, he didn't address this, I wonder whether his svar would lead to a chumrah the other way. Let's say my biological child was separated from me for 10 years. And now we get reunited. You know, if you use his argument that the reason why there's no isher yichud is because I raised him from infancy, well, if I didn't, would we then have the chumrah that there is an isser yichud with the child? I don't know. The Tzitz Eliezer didn't address the flip side of that problem. So lemaisa, if you're asking me how you should be somech, well, in the abstract, it would be easy to say follow most opinions. On the other hand, I did not follow that practice because in many cases, it's very, very necessary that an adopted child get a sense of love and security. So in a situation where there's any shita that is Mako, I believe it would be appropriate to follow that shita. So I would follow the shita that sits Eliezer. Of course, even that doesn't answer all questions. I have a friend who adopted a child who was 8 years old. Now, according to halacha, there is no halachic heter for yichud and chibuk v'nisha to the opposite gender when a child is 8 years old. Well, let me put it this way. I mean, maybe you could do it for 3 years, you know, at that age, but once they hit 11 or whatever it is, there would be that issue, right? So this is not going to solve all questions, but at least most adoptions are infancy adoptions. And with infancy, we at least have one halachic shita to be samichan. By the way, the same related issue, which is not the same issue, is how do you call an adopted child up to the Torah? Now, technically, if the adopted child was converted, is a goy, or was a goy, was converted, technically he's like any other ger, that would be called a Ben Avram, even Ben Avram Avinu. If he was a Jewish adopted child, technically his father is still his natural born father. But here the poskim say that although for a get or for a kesuva, you have to be very exact, but for an aliyah l'Torah, we do allow a child to be called up by his adopted father, because that was the father who raised him, and therefore we are making them that.
As far as I understand, we read Torah 3 times a week during Shabbos, and once, I guess, during Mincha. We read during Shabbos, Mondays and Thursdays, and during Mincha,
yep.
We read as well. And because we're not supposed to go to Montreal without learning. But on Shabbos, we learned Shabbos. So why would they be talking that you have to learn also on Mincha?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. That actually connects to what I mentioned before. You're right, it's not because of the 3 days. It's because of what is called Yoshvei Koronos. Yoshvei Koronos meant that, people still do it today even, that Shabbos afternoon was a free time. People weren't working, right? So they used to hang around the equivalent of the bars or the marketplace. I guess the bars weren't open, but they were not on Yerushalayim. But they would just hang around in the street and schmooze. And since they weren't working, they didn't really have anything to justify not learning. So Chazal, again, you have to envision Kriyas HaTorah as a mandatory learning seder. It wasn't so much a ritual. So Chazal were misakim precisely at the time when you have Yoshvei Koronos. We want to be misakim the public learning of Torah. So that's a special idea that Shabbos afternoon, people had a lot of free time in their hands. Yeah.
Basically, there's one of the proofs that people give to the existence of a creator is that basically, the world is so complicated that the creation could not have happened by chance. But some people challenge that argument. They say that any creator would therefore be necessarily more complicated than the creation, and therefore you would have the same problem again. How could the creator have come into existence if it being so complicated?
I mean, the problem of this is what's called infinite regression or infinite series. So let's analyze the argument. You're saying that the world is so complicated, right? There's so many phenomena that it's not possible that it could have existed without some intelligence that would organize it. So your argument is, so the creator, whatever nature the creator has, we would then say the same thing. So it's complicated. What the Rambam says, again, and I can't say I'm a complete bucky in this because I don't fully understand it either, but what the Rambam basically says is that since our understanding of the creator is that he's an indivisible unity, so the theory that complexity requires a creator only applies when you have multiplicity, meaning to say, we see in the world multiplicity. We see billions and billions of phenomena that are interacting together. So since, as a matter of chance and randomness, you would never see billions of phenomena interacting together, so the interaction of billions or trillions of phenomena presupposes a coordinated intelligence. Right? That's the argument from design. But that's an argument only because you have billions and billions of disparate phenomena come into being by themselves, because randomness would not lead to that type of coordination. But God, see, your argument would be true only if you say, okay, the world is billions of phenomena, so God is trillions of phenomena. But God is a single entity in which you're not going to, you would not, if, again, I don't even know how to describe this, but if you were to take a picture of God, you would not see billions of phenomena. It is an indivisible, what's called a simple unity. That's the actual term the Rambam uses. So in a simple unity, there is no longer any presupposition that it had to be created, it just existed. And the multiplicity comes out of that unity, right? So that would be the idea, that since God is not morkav mechalokim, you don't have the compulsion to presuppose there must have been some creator of that. That would be the philosophical argument. Yeah.
So I know we're supposed to be like a holy nation, and
yeah,
our goal is like, could you just explain what exactly holiness is in relation to like what we can?
Well, you know, this is the challenge of our lives. But a holy nation is a nation that makes the name of God beloved in the world. That by living according to Hashem's laws, people look at the Jewish people and they say they are wise people. They are a good people. They are living a life which brings peace to the world, blessing to the world, goodness to the world. And when you live that type of life, then you are a holy person. When you live a life in which people look at you and they say, oh, you know, you bring bad things to the world, you bring evil to the world, you bring dissension, machlokas, to the world, that would be not living a holy life. Now, this actually may be a relatively harsh statement to make in light of things you can imagine, but I think that's really it. Do you live a life that makes Hashem beloved in the world? And that is what holiness is. Yeah.
Why don't we know who Amalek are today? And hypothetically speaking, if I were to see an Amalek walking down Shimon HaTzadik, do I have to go and...
well, listen. Let me answer the second question. There is a machlokas rishayim. There is a machlokas rishayim. There are some rishayim that say, if you knew 100% that somebody is a descendant of the nation of Amalek, you would be chayav min haTorah to take a gun and kill the person. Now, if by doing so you might be risking your own life, so pikuach nefesh paters you, like any other mitzvah, but you would be chayav. If you could do it without anybody knowing, right, you could do it. Other rishayim, the Ketzer Mishnah brings, that eradication of Amalek is not going to be noyeg again till the days of Mashiach. And the svara for that, there's an interesting svara for that. They learn the mitzvah is not to kill an individual Amalekim. The mitzvah is to eradicate the nation. So, unless you're eradicating the whole nation, you don't have a mitzvah to kill this one and that one and that one. When, like Shaul, to kill the whole nation, then you have a mitzvah. So there is a machlekes, is the mitzvah to kill every individual Amalek? Or is the mitzvah to eradicate the nation, and therefore if you're not in a position where you have the whole nation there, you don't do it, right? So there's a machlokes rishayim. Now, all of this is academic, because we do not know who Amalek is. Now, there is a teaching b'shem Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the great Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, that any nation that wants to destroy the Jewish people is considered to be Amalek, even if they're not descended from Amalek. But even then, number one, it's not likely that Rav Chaim was saying it lahalacha. He was really talking about more of a spiritual idea of Amalek. He was not referring to the mitzvah of Mechias Amalek, which is very nation-specific. And number two, even then, you have to be careful who you identify as Amalek. For example, it would be clear under Rav Chaim's definition that Nazi Germany was Amalek because they wanted to wipe out the Jewish people. Islamic fundamentalism may not be the same thing. May not be the same thing. I'm saying it because, you know, they want our land, etc., but they don't necessarily, you know, want to destroy the Jewish people if we would simply roll over and give them Eretz Israel and the like. It's hard to know. Meaning, there are many different types of enemies and anti-Semites. Some are amalek and some are something else. And not everything is amalek in that sense. But be this as it may, regardless of how you characterize somebody spiritually, amalek we paskin is a descendant of a specific nation. Now, why we don't know who they are today, it could very well be, again, it's hard for us to know for sure, but one possible answer is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not want us to fulfill the mitzvah of eradicating the external Amalek until we have been misaking the inner Amalek within us. In other words, as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying, right now, I don't want you to focus on the outside. I want you to focus on the inside. And when you're misaking the inside, then you'll be able to deal with the outside. So that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu keeps it mechusa from us right now. Because otherwise, you'd be like a Muslim. You'd be focusing on the enemies outside that you want to destroy. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, that's not Avaida right now. Your main Avaida is Tikkun Bifnim. Yeah.
With the correct execution, no pun intended, of the mitzvah of wiping out Amalek, help make us beloved in the eyes of the world.
Well, that is a good question. I mean, certainly.
Make Hashem belong. Make Hashem belong in the eyes of the world. Make us a holy nation.
Yeah. Well. So you're saying that this contradicts the picture that I painted before of what the goals of the Torah are. You know, it is a question, but I can just tell you. You know, you may have read this when you were a kid. There was a short story by Roald Dahl about. There's a whole story about a little baby, a beautiful little baby who had a terrible pneumonia, and the baby couldn't breathe, and it was gasping for breath, and a mother called a doctor, and the mother was pleading and begging and crying, could you help my little, cute little baby? So the story ended. Let's say you knew with 100% certainty, 100% certainty, that baby was Adolf Hitler. And you knew with 100% certainty, again, this is all hypothetical, what this baby will grow up to do. What would you do at that moment? Would you say, it's a pure, beautiful, helpless, cute little baby. How can I let it die? Or would you, shoot the baby or at least let the baby die? Now, Dahl's point was this. Dahl's point was, that all of us get swept up in the emotionality of the actual person we're looking at. But in reality, there are long-term consequences that might be much more devastating. Now, this is totally imaginary hypothetical because we don't know the future. But the one entity that knows the future is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And apparently, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, wipe out Amalek, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying that these cute little Amalekite babies are going to be the Adolf Hitlers of the future. And what looks like total cruelty is in fact something that is going to actually help the world in the long run. Now, will the world recognize it? That I can't tell you. But you see the point here. In other words, Hashem knows the future. Hashem is telling you from these cute Amalekites there will be evil and devastation. Now, let me just remind you of another halacha. An Amalekite can convert to Judaism. And an Amalekite can even spare his life by accepting the seven commandments of Noach. The Gemara tells us Haman's own descendants converted and became teachers of Torah. So there's hope even for Amalekite. But the mitzvah of killing is based on those that you're told to kill are, going to be the evil. Yeah.
Based on that, how do you understand how Hashem treated Yishmael, that he judged him based on how he is now and not who he's going to grow up to be?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Because if you're saying that the destruction of Amalek is because of what they will become, is that not a contradiction to Asher Husham, which says Yishmael is judged? Now, let me just mention that there's another question as well. Do you remember in the Parsha in the Torah, the Ben Sorer Umorah, the rebellious son, gets executed not for what he did. All he did was steal some wine and meat, but because of what he will become. That too is a contradiction. So the Marsha says in Maseches Rosh Hashanah that when Yishmael is judged for what he is, that means Yishmael is not going to be judged harshly for what his descendants will do. The Ben Sorer Umorah, however, is judged harshly for what he will do. And we could say the same thing for Amalek, right? It's only the Yishmael, it was the future descendants that would do bad things. Okay,
when the Baba Kareba used to say a Sifas Mamorim, I can't remember which one, he used to hold onto like a handkerchief. And I've heard that he did that because like that he wanted to hold onto something physical, so could it touch harm my drag or something. Is that like a viable thing?
Yes. You know, again, we're not Mekubalim, so I can't tell you for sure. But there is a concept that a tzaddik who is in very, very deep, ecstatic mamorim of Kabbalah, probably a mimer, I would guess, more than a sicha. For those of you who may not know, the sicha in Chabad Hasidus is a more informal, folksy type of chat. A mimer is more of a heavy, Kabbalistic thing. So probably it was a mimer, but my guess. So it is very true that when a mekubal is osek in the very, very depths of the Torah, the neshama has such a yearning to be with Hashem that the neshama might leave the body. I had mentioned Ari Kaplan, that's how, actually wrote that you shouldn't engage in meditations without another person in the room so the person can bring you back in case you just die. You know, your neshama flies away. So it's very conceivable. I would understand the idea that he wants to be rooted in a physical reality that the neshama shouldn't leave the guf. I don't know if it's true, but I could understand it. Yeah. I heard another thing. I think I once heard about the handkerchief. I think it was also an idea of, I think it was a handkerchief of his father-in-law, or maybe even before that, and it was an idea of also trying to feel the spirits of the other Rabbeim guiding him as well. I think it was connected to that. Yeah.
Is there a heder for women because of harming your own body?
Yeah, so there's a general, you know, body piercing generally is usher because you're not allowed to wound yourself because your body belongs to Hashem. Now, nose piercing, all those things are not proper. We are nekel, although some people are machmer, but most of the Torah world, as you can probably see, is very, very nekel with women at least piercing their ears, even as babies, little babies get their ears pierced, because since it is generally done in the soft cartilage in the base of the ear, and once you remove the earring, it just heals and seals up very quickly, so it's not considered a permanent type of puncture, and therefore it's not nichlal in the yisur of chabura. If you do piercing up here already, the harder cartilage, then that would be more of a shiloh. But we are mekel at the bottom part. Now, for a man to do it, would be the same. It would be equally mutter, except for the fact that since it is done primarily for women, there would be an isser of a man dressing up in a woman's clothing. It wouldn't be because of chabura, it would be because of leisil bashgever. By the way, just you may have, not that it's worth your time, but you know, there's a bit of a mini scandal, I don't know if it's a scandal, two modern Orthodox high schools in New York publicly are allowing girls to wear tefillin. Now, and this reignited a bit of a discussion about women wearing tefillin. So let me just give you a very quick little answer to this. Women are, of course, putter from tefillin. We know that because tefillin is a time-bound commandment. The mitzvah is Eishes Zman Kerama because we don't wear tefillin at night and we don't wear it on Shabbos. Now, just because women are paturos, that wouldn't in and of itself say that they're forbidden, because we have many mitzvahs asay, shazman grama, that women are allowed to and even encouraged to. They could take lulav, they could hear shofar, they could sit in a sukkah. Now, whether they can make a bracha is a machlokes, Rabbeinu Tam and the Rambam. Rabbeinu Tam says when a woman does a time-bound commandment like lulav, she can even make a bracha, asher kiddushanu b'mitzvosav. According to the Rambam, she cannot make a bracha. The Ramah, Paskins like Rabbeinu Tam, so for Ashkenazim, women make a bracha. Sfardim, or the Shulchan Aruch, Paskins like the Rambam, that women don't make a bracha, but according to everybody, they can do the mitzvah, and they do get the reward of an Eino Mitzvah Viosa. No, they get some reward as an Eino Mitzvah. Now, based on that data alone, if that's the only data you had, you would actually conclude, so let a woman wear tefillin. She can take a lulav if she wants. So why can't she wear tefillin if she wants? And indeed, the Gemara does tell us, Michal, Shaul's daughter, and there is a story, but it's not really authenticated, that Rashi's daughters wore tefillin. But again, we don't really have a definite raya for that. Very good. Now, however, the Kalba, one of the Rishonim, and the Rama brings the Kalba Lahalacha, says that tefillin is different than any other mitzvah, such as mangrama, and a woman should not wear tefillin. And there are two reasons that are given for this. One reason that's given is based on the Targum Yonason in the Chumash, on the Pasuk, Laisilbash Isha Simlas Gever, a woman should not wear a man's garment. Targum Yonason says, Elu Talis and Tefillin, which means it's a new halacha, not because of Zman Grama only, that the Torah designates tzitzis and tefillin as a levush of a man, which would mean a woman can't wear it because of that. Now, that's not the reason the Rama gives. The Rama gives a reason that since tefillin requires a clean body, so if somebody has a problem with either flatulence or body waste and the like, so one doesn't wear tefillin. So since tefillin needs a clean body, so women have a problem of not a gufnaki. Now, that's what the Rama says. Now, the problem is, what does that mean? Why does a woman have more of a problem of a gufnaki than a man? What is the unique problem? So some interpret the Rama in terms of the additional factor of menstruation, that they treat menstruation as negating gufnaki, although that's a little difficult because menstruation is not body waste in the same way. But okay. But the Aruch HaShulchan, I think, gives the best explanation of the Rama. The Aruch HaShulchan says that the Rama doesn't mean to say women are less capable than men. They're both the same. But let's look at a man. The original minhag of tefillin is you wore tefillin the whole day. Why do we cut it down to only Kriya Shema and Shemone Esrei, davening? So the reason is because as the Doros became less capable, less Yiras Shemayim and the like, we became less capable of Shemira, of Gufnaki, and also Kavana, of Hesech Hadas, etc. So what we do is, tefillin is a mitzvah that you cut down to the bare minimum. Meaning, you don't do more than you have to. That rule, the Aruch HaShulchan says, is true for men, and true for women. Don't do more than you have to. For a man who has to do something, our minimum is shachris. A woman who doesn't have to, her minimum is zero. In other words, the point the Aruch HaShulchan is making is, because of the kedushas tefillin, and the difficulty of the right kavana and even the right state of body, you don't do it on an optional basis. The same reason a man does not wear it the whole day is the reason why a woman does not wear it even during chakras. Why does a man wear it during chakras? Because he has to. A woman doesn't have to. The tefillin is not an optional mitzvah. It's not one of those things you do because you want to do it. It's not like lulav and the like. Now, having said that, and this may maybe get me in trouble, if an individual woman in the privacy of her home feels that she's capable of the right kavanas and the like, then halacha might allow it, because what the Rama is condemning is doing it publicly and making it a common practice, because it cannot be assumed that people are capable of the kavanas. Individual basis, yes. And in fact, I've heard anecdotally, although I don't have any proof of this, people anecdotally, there are like old, Rebbetzins and Meir Sharif who put on tefillin in private, like Micha Bashal. Again, I don't have any proof of this. But all I'm saying is, halacha would in theory allow it, just as there were always individual women who learned Gemara, individually and privately, some of whom became actually Bekiyam and Shas. But it's not necessarily something you implement on a public level. So that's just a little bit of hakdama about the tefillin story. So if any of your aunts and uncles or parents ask you about it, you'll be able to give some type of... But I'll tell you, you can see what this is going on, because I happened to see a picture of the two girls wearing tefillin. I mean, it was like a joke, They're like, parading in their tefillin like you'd parade in a baseball cap or something like that. I mean, obviously, you can see the idea. Tefillin is a very, very holy thing. And it's forbidden, really, to joke in your tefillin. It's not proper to even shmooze a sichas chulin in tefillin. one has to be aware that the shame of Hashem is upon them and behave with great, great seriousness. It's not a joke, and it's not a statement, and it's not an occasion to make some feminist idea that, you know, girls are as good as boys or whatever it would be. So, as I say, so if somebody does it privately and they're really doing it to certain, you know, because they feel it brings them closer to Hashem, there may be a makom to be nekel on it, ein achinami. Although Sfardim would not make a bracha, Ashkenazim would even make a bracha. But when it's part of a political statement of egalitarianism, it's a great, great bizayon to the holiness of tefillin. Okay, you take care. Have a good day.
Thanks so much.